Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on March 30th, 2018. This is the 11th week of our 2019 Saturday Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Sambodhi Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So today is the first week of 3 weeks on the three marks of existence. Understanding the three marks of existence is really the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma. And one of the reasons why I'm saying that is the modern mindfulness movement, and this is a great generalization for the purposes of simply making a point. Most of the modern mindfulness movement is to be mindful of all, each and every, not the right way to say it. Is to be mindful of all phenomena arising and passing away, but to the point where that in itself is distracting. In other words, there's no dhammic value. It doesn't relate to the Dhamma by thinking that you must be always analyzing what's going on in your mind. That's just another distraction. But because of the way that it's often taught, that mindfulness means to be mindful of each and every thing that you're doing, only leads to distraction. It doesn't lead to a quiet and calm and peaceful mind that has created the internal environment for a true insight to arise, meaning insight into the three marks of existence. And to qualify that, I'm not putting down most of modern mindfulness. It's brought some great benefits to people. But because of the lack of focus, a good portion of what people are considering as mindfulness practice is actually leading to some pretty disturbing mind states if you don't have the proper structure. And I won't get into that. The Buddha taught this very specific insight into the three marks of existence, the impermanence of all things, the not self characteristic, and the resulting unsatisfactory, disappointing, stressful experiences that follow from a misunderstanding of those first two. Is that clear, what mm-hmm. I just said? So you could say that impermanence and the not self characteristic are really components, necessary components of suffering as the Buddha is describing suffering. Again, here's maybe a silly metaphor to make that point. Bashing myself in the head with a hammer would say that the hammer and the action itself is a component of the suffering that follows from doing that, right? You follow me? Maybe a stupid act, but it's just as ignorant to insist on living in the world from views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. It's constantly hitting ourselves in the head with this hammer. So they are components of suffering, and they're components of suffering just as much as if I grabbed a hold of impermanence or I grabbed a hold of the not self-characteristic wrong views of self and beat myself up with it. Because that's what we do. We attach ourselves to impermanence, the impermanence of all things, all thoughts, all events, thoughts, words, and ideas are all impermanent, yet we attach a self to them and we describe ourselves in relation to the world based on those fabrications. Is that clear? So we create an identity over clinging to fabricated people, events, views, and ideas. But because they're impermanent and ever-changing, there's no satisfaction, there's no safety, there's no refuge. But once we do it, and once we insist this is what we need to be happy and what we need to avoid to stay happy, we create fabrications about how we look at the world. Dependent origination state. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes fabrications. From fabrications, I won't go through the whole thing, comes the problem of continued eye-making. So these three marks of existence impermanence, the not-self-characteristic, and dukkha, are taught to understand them, but understand them at a profound level. And the Buddha teaches that by describing awakening from right view. Right view is a profound understanding of the nature of suffering, which it means that it's a profound understanding of all three components. Is that clear? So that is the specific insight that the Buddha is teaching us. Relating back to how I started, it's good to be mindful of what you're doing. If you're washing the dishes, it's best to be mindful that that's what you're doing. But to think that being mindful of washing the dishes is Dhamma practice is simply confusing and misleading, because it's not. It's the result. But many, many people substitute that type of objectified mindfulness. I think you'll be able to see this, is now my Dhamma practice is while I'm washing dishes, I should be mindful of it. And I create a stress level of being mindful of the washing the dishes, rather than having the underlying right view that I'm just doing the dishes. There's not any right or wrong or good or bad or even any value in doing the dishes. It's simply something that I'm doing. But the value is in being mindful of what I'm doing moment by moment as my life occurs. The significant difference there is making a Dhamma practice about being mindful of the dishes, then substitutes that mindfulness for the dishes for mindfulness as the Buddha teaches mindfulness of the three marks of existence. It is very subtle, but again, if you're overly mindful, which is really saying mindless over washing the dishes because you're so focused on being mindful of the dishes, you'll miss the experience of impermanence and the not self-fabricated views that you would otherwise encounter during that, including the frustration is, why the heck am I having to do dishes again? By being mindful of just doing the dishes, you're ignoring the fact that you don't like doing the dishes. Mm-hmm. Peace of mind comes from confronting the fact that you don't like doing the dishes and not trying to find a reason why you should like them, because there is no reason why you should like doing the dishes, but you should not like them. You should simply do the dishes. Do you see? That's the significant difference between making a practice over something that you simply should be mindful of and actually practicing the mindfulness that the Buddha is teaching. Yes, Anthony.
I disagree a little bit on how you're defining mindfulness, because John Kabat-Zinn defines mindfulness as non-judgmental, moment-to-moment awareness of thoughts, feelings, bodily sensations, the breath. It's not meant to be distracting, and it's not meant to, what was the other word you used? I forget what the other word was. It's not meant to analyze. Mm-hmm. It's just meant to observe what's going on. So the reason it's useful is, like, if someone has a chronic pain syndrome, they'll amplify that syndrome by focusing on the pain and biting down on it and trying to resist it. Yes. So it just teaches you to go with the flow and observe your experience, but not to analyze it or become distracted by it. Just to allow it to pass, like we allow our breath to pass.
Yes, and you just
married with the Dharma. I think it's more powerful, but they don't marry it with the Dharma because they'll never be able to do it in schools or hospitals or anywhere else, because then it becomes a religious experience that people don't like.
That may be true too. I don't mean to interrupt you, but that may be true, and I don't want to get into that part of it, because what I teach, what the Buddha teaches, is not religion at all. And I think I have great respect for John Kabat-Zinn. I'm not putting him down, but I think that's a short-sighted view, and I would actually say it lacks a little bit of courage too. But now to get back, you made a point, and mindfulness-based stress reduction has brought great benefit. I'm all for it, but I think it's so important to point out that's not what the Buddha taught. The description that John Kabat-Zinn is a good description of mindfulness. To me, a better description and more to the point is mindfulness simply means to recollect or to hold in mind dispassionately.
Right.
Because that's really what it is. Now, when I'm using mindfulness-based stress reduction to resolve the pain in my knee during a meditation practice, I no longer have a concentration practice. I'm engaged in pain therapy. It's simply two different things. And engaging in pain therapy is a distraction from deepening concentration. It's simply two different things. So, and it relates to the point that I'm making. It's great to use, well, I shouldn't say it's great because I'm a person, I have a lot of chronic and often very, very severe pain. And I find my direct meditation practice is much more successful in allowing me to work with my pain than the mindfulness-based stress reduction pain treatment that is taught.
Well, they're selling it as therapy, but if you're on the cushion and you're having pain in your leg, you have two choices. You can get up and shake it off if it becomes too overwhelming and you can't sustain your focus on the breath, or you can just be with that experience and hope it dissolves.
Again, Andy, I don't
but
mean
that's not doing therapy. That's just getting through your meditation.
No, you've now substituted the instructions for meditation. When you're distracted by anything, including pain anywhere, you come back to the sensation of breathing.
Well, what if you can't? What if it's too painful?
But if it's too painful, you don't substitute pain therapy for a concentration practice. Only because it doesn't increase your concentration. I don't want to get into an argument with you.
It's
two different applications of mindfulness. And so if we're going to develop concentration, we need to do a concentration practice. If we want to engage in pain management, then we engage. And I would say if your focus and intention is pain management, learn everything you can about mindfulness-based stress reduction, if that's as far as you want to go. If you want to understand the nature of suffering, it requires a well-concentrated mind, and then I would suggest you use a meditation practice, not a pain therapy practice. Again, even as the Buddha teaches, he teaches to be mindful of the breath in the body, not mindful of pain in the body. It's two different things. And again, it's not putting down mindfulness-based stress reduction, it's simply making a clear distinction as to what one is. That's all.
Yeah, I mean, look, all I'm saying is there may be times where you can't sustain your breath for whatever reason. You're too tired, too much pain,
and what I suggest,
whatever it is.
Right?
And what I suggest is get up off your cushion and do it again when you're ready for it.
Right, but then you're not sustaining your focus on the breath.
You're not listening to me, Anthony. You're conditioning your mind to say that I can't meditate because I have to deal with pain. Okay, then decide that you no longer have a meditation practice, you're engaging in pain management. That's fine. But if you want to be a Dhamma practitioner, I teach that you should meditate as the Buddha teaches meditation. And so for someone who wants to engage in both a pain management, I'm getting too far off course here, sorry. If someone wants to engage in a pain management therapy, fine, do that. And then if you want to have a meditation practice that increases concentration, do that separate and understand that it's separate. If you can't do both, if you're so tired or so full of pain, stop and try it again. But that's all covered by the Eightfold Path and right effort. Right effort tells me that there's clear and direct instructions for a meditation practice that is covered by right effort. If I want to engage in the effort of developing the Dhamma, I'll do this. And again, I'm not putting that down, but I am trying to make a clear distinction between mindfulness as it applies to what the Buddha teaches and mindfulness as it applies to everything else. Mm-hmm. You can say that a good teacher of auto mechanics is going to teach you how to be mindful of how to change the oil. They're not going to give a darn about teaching concentration, will they? Because that's not their focus. John Kabat-Zinn's focus wasn't to teach people how to deepen their concentration. He was teaching people how to manage their pain. He's teaching two different things.
Well, I would agree with that, but I think he is teaching people how to deepen their concentration.
Okay, well,
just not with the Buddhist experience.
Okay, well, that's fine. And again, this is a class about what the Buddha taught. And so that's
no. I think that married together is very powerful.
Well, then I gotta say, marrying it. I hope this doesn't seem like I'm arguing with you, Anthony. I'm trying to do is to really preserve the Buddha's Dhamma as pure as it possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And so, even the idea of marrying, mm-hmm, goes directly to the idea of clinging, doesn't it? And so, wait a minute. So, because I've seen this, it's not you, Anthony. I've seen this with so many, many people. Finding something in your meditation that you can substitute for the act of deepening concentration is so prevalent today. In fact, it's encouraged. And so find something that you like or that you feel is effective and do that rather than have a concentration practice.
No, when I said marry together, I meant the focus on the breath plus the practice.
The Dhamma practice,
yes.
Right. Yeah.
Well, okay. Right. I'll say that it is... The difficulty is in marrying the two and seeing it as one practice, because it's not. And I would say that you cannot progress past a certain point until you actually separate the two. And again, as I said, I wouldn't say don't use mindfulness for a pain therapy. Just don't make it part of your Dhamma practice. And I would avoid marrying the two, just like I wouldn't take instructions from my auto mechanic on how to change my oil. I wouldn't take instructions from him on how to prune my rose bushes. He might know a lot about one subject, but he doesn't know anything about the other. John Kabat-Zinn knows a lot about one subject, but he doesn't know anything about what the Buddha taught, and so he doesn't teach it.
Well, I think he does. He just doesn't teach it. He is a Buddhist.
Again, I really gotten way off track. He's a modern Buddhist. I'll give you that, which means he knows very little about what the Buddha actually taught.
No, I think he does. I just don't think he intentionally incorporated into mindfulness.
I think if he did, he would have. That's why I'm saying that. I think the most powerful pain therapy in the world from direct experience is the Buddha's Dhamma. Becca, you had your hand up? And again, I'm sorry if I sound like I'm arguing
because,
with you. I'm not.
I don't have any experience with any other practice. I don't know who you're talking about. But... I'm sitting up here in the chair now because when I sit on the cushion the last several times, I realized that pain in certain parts of my body were distracting me from my concentration. And I found that I kept being pulled out by this uncomfortableness. So that's why I moved here, so that I can concentrate the way you have explained what concentration during meditation is, and that's all I have to say.
Yeah, thank you. And that was the wise decision, to just move, rather than think that you have to. You should work through your pain. I've been to many monasteries and meditation centers all over the world. I used to go often to Zen Mountain Monastery almost every Sunday. And there would always be a line of long-term meditators sitting against both walls. There used to get 150 people up there, sitting along both of these walls, sitting in chairs and meditating. Most of them were monks and nuns. Some people would think, well, how can that be? You might have to sit on the floor to meditate. It doesn't matter where you're doing, where you're sitting, as long as you're sitting quietly. So it's a good decision that you made, rather than fighting with your pain. But again, to get back to what Anthony was saying, and again, I'm not trying to put you down at all.
Oh, you're not putting me down.
But just to understand.
I just felt I needed to correct something.
Yeah, just to understand, there's a difference between mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based stress elimination. It's two different things. And the practice itself, even though it's similar, and this is another reason why meditation gets so misconstrued with other practices, meaning a concentration practice, is because it is similar. Anthony described it briefly. There's a lot more to MBSR than just being mindful of pain in your knee, but basically that's what it is. That's not what it is. But that's one of the techniques that you would use in pain therapy. So while I'm sitting here in my my meditation session and I'm putting my mindfulness on my pain, it's no longer on my breath. And I'm distracted now by the pain. Or anything else that we might use. It could be a visualization. So let me get to tonight. Are we finished, Anthony?
I didn't want to take up so much time. I just felt I needed to correct the interpretation of mindfulness.
The Buddha was at Anathapindika's monastery at Jeta's Grove. He asked those gathered, friends, If those of other sects would ask you, what are the prerequisites for developing the wings of self-awakening, how would you respond? Prerequisites, meaning what do you need to do first? What do you have to build your awakening foundation on? The monks and nuns asked the Buddha to tell them his response so that they would remember it clearly. Listen closely then. The prerequisites for developing the wings to self-awakening are here for you, meaning that they're available to everyone who wishes to integrate the Dhamma. Having admirable friends and companions, that's the first one. But what does it mean? The Buddha doesn't mean to find companions that are morally and ethically pure, although that's important. Remember, everything the Buddha taught is in the context of the Dhamma. So having admirable friends and companions means having admirable friends and companions within the Dhamma, friends and companions that are actually developing the Buddha's Dhamma. And this is such a common theme. It's in so many suttas because the Buddha understood how easily a mind rooted in ignorance will grasp onto other things to continue to ignore its own ignorance. And one of the most powerful ways of doing that is following what your friends are doing and what your associations are doing, especially in modern Buddhism, but really everywhere else. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't associate with anybody that's not a Dhamma practitioner. It just simply means we should keep our Dhamma practice pure if we hope to develop it fully. Remaining virtuous and restrained and understanding the danger of even the slightest faults. Remember when the Buddha was talking about the right speech, right action, and right livelihood, the three moral or virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path. He concluded that with being mindful of our behavior, we develop that to the point to understand that even in the slightest, that we're mindful of even the slightest fault. In other words, we stop kidding ourselves that we can act in hurtful ways and get away with it. Even if it's very subtle, it's still hurtful. It's interesting that one of the religion that I grew up in, purgatory, Roman Catholicism, came up with this idea of purgatory because I think they realized that it's impossible to tell us that we can never be without sin. But it becomes pretty hopeless when you're going to go to hell if you sin. But if you're not too bad, you get to work it out in purgatory. Well, that the Buddha realized that there's no such thing as that we create our own purgatory or our own hell depending on the level of our ignorance. And so we can extricate ourselves from understanding these three marks of existence. Hearing easily, sober talk, and talks conducive to gaining understanding. Hearing talks on modesty, contentment, the value of seclusion and quiet, non-entanglement, persistence, virtue, concentration, discernment, and the knowledge of true vision and release from craving and clinging. This is kind of a loaded question, Anthony. Mm-hmm. When you were taking your NBSR training, was there a focus on knowledge of vision and release from craving and clinging?
Only in the sense of wanting your experience to be different than it is.
So again, not to beat you up, but you see the contradiction to the Buddha's Dhamma in that statement?
No.
Wanting something to be different than it is?
Well, it's more of acceptance.
Okay, but those are two different things. Acceptance is not wanting something to be different than it is. In fact, it's just the opposite.
No, not wanting something to be different than it is. It's not expecting something to be different than it is.
Okay. All right. Remaining persistent for abandoning unskillful mental qualities and for developing skillful mental qualities. Resolute and right effort. That's what right effort is. Furthermore, for one developing the wings to self-awakening, they would maintain discernment and understanding of impermanence and the cessation of stress. Read that last. Furthermore, for one developing the wings to understanding, to self-awakening, they would maintain discernment and understanding of impermanence and the cessation of stress. In other words, that's the focus. That's what we're looking for. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will be virtuous and restrained, seeing danger in the slightest faults. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will easily hear sober talk and talks conducive to gaining understanding. In other words, the time you're putting on listening to people is time listening to the Dhamma as part of your Dhamma practice. You can, and the point would be, you can listen to all the wonderful teachers that you want, inspiring people, wonderful. Most people teaching others are sincere in their belief systems. But if they're not teaching the Dhamma, they can't teach you the Dhamma, can they? It just makes sense. And again, when we conflate the two, and I'm not beating you up by using the word again, but when you marry something to something, you're conflating the two, aren't you, in most cases? And so you're no longer seeing it clearly.
Yeah, no, John, I meant the similarity between our practice and mindfulness is that there both is an awareness of the breath meditation. And I meant marrying the awareness of the breath with the practice is more powerful. That was my point.
With the practice of what practice?
Of the Dharma.
Of the Dharma.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So he was agreeing with you.
I was agreeing with you.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you for agreeing with me. and you just bring up some important points that are prevalent today. You know, and really what the prevalence is, I found something that I can do, that I like to do, that makes me feel good. I'll call it meditation and I'll do it. And I'm not saying that's just what you're doing, but that's what is done often. And the point that I'm making is that when you substitute any meditation practice for a concentration practice, you're simply not practicing the Dhamma. You're doing something else. That's fine. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected they will hear sober talk and talks conducive to gaining understanding. They will hear talks on modesty, contentment, the value of seclusion and quiet, non-entanglement, persistence, virtue, concentration, discernment, and the knowledge of true vision and release from craving and clinging. When one had admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will maintain discernment and understanding of impermanence and the cessation of stress. I mentioned that I spent a lot of time at different places. Zen Mountain was one of them, KTD up in Woodstock, a big... that's a North American seat of the Karmapa. Both wonderful places with wonderful people. All the time I was there, which was a lot of sessions up there, I never heard any of that type of talk there. Never. I certainly never was taught, ever, in all those, every other place, I was never taught the importance of gaining an understanding of impermanence or the not self-care. In fact, I was taught that I wasn't taught the not self characteristic. I was taught that there was no such thing as a self and everything is one vast empty void. I can't think of anything more deflating and untrue. Once these qualities are developed, there are four more to develop. Contemplation of what is unattractive so as to abandon craving. Goodwill should be developed so as to abandon ill will. Mindfulness of the breath in the body should be developed so as to develop non-distraction, a well-concentrated mind. They should develop understanding of impermanence so as to uproot conceit and end further eye-making. They should develop understanding of impermanence so as to uproot conceit and end further eye-making. It is through the understanding, the profound and penetrative understanding, excuse me, I probably shouldn't drink between sentences.
It's a pregnant pause.
I forgot what I was saying. They should develop understanding of impermanence so as to root out conceit and end further eye-making. The entire three marks of existence are in that one sentence, isn't it? Because the inference is eye-making is suffering. I did it twice. And it is through understanding impermanence that I understand eye-making and can let it go. People understand, do you understand that? Do you understand the mechanism of that?
I understand it, but I don't always see it that way in real life. My three marks of existence, I concentrate more on focusing on me establishing myself in other realms, which is anatta.
Yeah. And could you clarify that? Because you know... you really have a profound understanding of other realms. Another realm could be, I'm going to be the best rose pruner.
Right.
Right. You understand that?
Yeah. You know that.
That's why you're going to that class?
Yeah.
Does everybody else understand that? That's just an imagination. That's just as speculative as saying, when I die, I'm going to Buddhist heaven.
Well, other realms realms is just not what's happening now.
That's right. That's it. Mm-hmm. It's just not.
And all realms are fabricated. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
I think I've said right. So that's how I. But the impermanence. I need to be reminded. Yeah. And I don't sort of focus on it. Although when we come to class, we see that. You know, we'll see what we can see in the teachings, but you understand the it needs to be impermanence, needs to be interwoven to anatta, and you see that. But when you get outside and you...
That's interesting, because I feel like I'm hyper-focused on impermanence.
We should
find our heads together. And yeah, when you don't integrate the other two, then it's just you're still suffering.
Yeah, I got an email from a student who was just starting to take the course. Mm-hmm. This is a couple of years ago, and he said, "Why are you putting so much emphasis on impermanence?" I understand impermanence, and we do, don't we? Mm-hmm. But we don't understand it at the most profound level. At I-making, that I'm trying to establish a permanent self based on my likes and dislikes in an environment that simply doesn't support that type of thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it really is that true.
Yeah.
I can think the way I want to think. I can hold on to my fabrications. This is what the Buddha taught. I can insist that my fabrications are true forever and ever and ever. It doesn't make them true. And because I insisted they're true, because I believe my fabrications, that's the not self characteristic, I'm going to suffer. It's simple. If I don't understand who I am and what I am in the environment that I am, suffering's gonna follow, isn't it? Just is. And that's the Buddha's teaching. So as we continue to deepen our understanding of all of this, our understanding of impermanence deepens and we see how it relates. So it's not just okay, in a physical way, I understand everything is impermanent. Most of us get that. But we don't understand how we create a fabricated self, attaching ourselves to what are impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas, but thinking that we can somehow establish permanence there. When the Buddha used the term anatta, the not-self characteristic, what he was referring to is that the views we're holding of a self do not constitute a self. They're not a self. They're anatta. Let go of the views. It's the views that perpetuate, views rooted in ignorance that perpetuate this disappointing experience in an environment of impermanence. As I understand and abandon those wrong views, I'm still living in this environment, aren't I? But I'm no longer attached to things being one certain way. I've learned radical acceptance. And again, not to beat up that subject, another application of that would be during my meditation, and this is really true for me, Anthony, and maybe I'll say this to everybody, I am almost virtually pain-free when I'm meditating. But before and after meditation, I can be in pretty excruciating pain. And I don't do anything else except meditate. And the point that I'm trying to make here is that the time that I'm spent on my cushion, if I was using that time to manage my pain, which I might have to if I wasn't doing what I'm doing, I wouldn't be deepening my concentration. I wouldn't have a Dhamma practice. I'd be doing something else. And I could do that with any type of substitution. If I'm using one of the most foremost modern teachers doesn't teach sitting meditation hardly at all. He teaches walking meditation because that's what he likes. But there's really no such thing as walking meditation. The Buddha didn't teach us to be mindful of our feet. He taught us to be mindful of our breath and to find a secluded spot. It's a good idea to be mindful that you're walking when you're walking. But not to substitute that as a meditation practice. Or some people call visualization meditation. In other words, they quiet their mind and they think of a picture of the Buddha or a candle or a flower or a sunset. And that's their practice. Well, that's fine, but it's not a meditation practice. It's not a concentration practice. Okay. For when one understands impermanence, clinging to anatta, clinging to wrong views of self. Clinging to anatta is abandoned. Understanding not self uproots conceit. Unbinding arises in this moment. When we understand the not self characteristic and its insistence on establishing a self and recognizing that and abandoning it, awakening arises in this moment. I'll read it again because this describes the entire Dhamma. For when one understands impermanence, clinging to not self is abandoned. Understanding not self uproots conceit. Unbinding arises in this moment. Does everybody get that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And so the singular importance of gaining insight into impermanence and the not self characteristic, rather than taking on a practice and calling that practice an insight practice, and now I'm going to gain insight into everything that occurs in my mind. In fact, the meditation method that's often taught there is to quiet your mind by being mindful of the breath and then spend your meditation time following your train of thought. And that only increases distraction, doesn't it? It's really the same thing we're doing in a structured way in an off our cushions, unstructured, just staying in that story in our minds. What, are we going to say something?
No.
I'm sorry. And when one has seen the five clinging aggregates as they really are, the arising and the passing away, understanding the attraction and the distraction of those five clinging aggregates, seeing the arising of desire and the continued delusion, and being delivered from the five clinging aggregates, this one is released from clinging. All defilements are destroyed, greed, aversion, and deluded thinking is destroyed. What must be done has been done. What must be done? Remember, this is the Buddha teaching this. This is what must be done. These are the prerequisites to awakening. And when you do that, when you see the five clinging aggregates as they really are, this one is released from clinging. All defilements destroyed. What must be done has been done. Perfection is attained. The burden has been put down. The highest goal attained. This one is liberated by perfect insight. Thank you. That last line is so important, too. It points to the perfect insight that we're developing as Dhamma practitioners. And it's very important. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't take our well-concentrated mind and learn different subjects or anything else like that. But as far as a Dhamma is concerned, it's insight into these three marks of existence. So let's just go around the room. Questions come up. Jen, good to see you this morning.
Hi, good to see you. I guess I'm a little bit distracted by the conversation that Anthony and you were having, and that's not, that's mine. But I've generally sense within me a frustration with the knowledge that the Dhamma is developing a concentration practice that will eventually lead to stress reduction in all forms. And that is within our society attached to a religion. And that makes it less accessible to that, in my view, which is a wrong view, makes it less accessible to others because they have to get through all of our wrong thinking in order to be concentrated enough to really engage in the Dhamma. And maybe that's because of you, but maybe somehow your frustration has, that's become, I've learned that, I don't know, but it's definitely frustrating because I want, you know, and that's again clinging. I want to share that with others, and I don't see how to do it without it having this religious, you know,
connotation.
And yeah. So there's a, you know, and I agree with what I already feel like I know what you're going to say, even though I know I can't mind read.
You know I'm going to say it anyway.
Is that you can't not teach the Dhamma. It can't not be that. Because if you're doing anything else, it's watered down. And
yeah.
So, but there's also value in that watering down, but I don't feel like, having learned the Dhamma from you, I feel like I can't, you know, for me personally, I can't like teach it any other way. And, you know, I am taking the teaching course, so, and I am a teacher, so I'm definitely, it's just something that's been in my head a lot, quite a bit. So thank you both for having that discussion, really, is what I mean, because
yeah.
It's been in my mind too.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up. And, there, boy, you said, and I mean, you understand the reason why I structured the teacher training the way I did.
Yeah,
there's some
yeah,
guidelines
yeah.
if you want to read them.
Right.
Is to develop more teachers that understand the importance, mostly,
yeah.
of keeping it focused.
Yeah, yeah.
Ever since I started teaching, which was right at the next building over, 7, 8, 9 years ago, and it's not so much now, but there was always a push, and sometimes, you know, a pretty heavy push, to do other things here at Cross River Meditation Center,
mm-hmm.
to incorporate different teachers, mm-hmm. or why don't we listen to Tara Brach this week, and Pema that next week, and well, because they don't teach what the Buddha. Again, I'm not putting them down that
no,
way, but
no,
they don't
yeah.
teach. They don't teach the Dhamma, and so, and the other problem of the Buddha's Dhamma, or Buddhism in general as a religion, is simply something that is part of the world,
yeah,
and it
right,
was part
right.
of the, it was part of the Buddha's world too. In other words, he didn't teach his Dhamma in any way as a religion. He
right.
was very clear in making sure people understood this isn't religion.
Yeah, yeah.
This is simply a way of developing a calm and peaceful
yes.
mind. And so I try to present it that way as
right.
much as I can. But because it has, there's a few components to what the Buddha teaches that are similar to religion. And so it's just religion.
Yeah.
Even meditation is taught in some religions. But the emphasis on morals and ethics makes everyone see Buddhism as religion. But
yeah.
they don't understand why he didn't teach morals to be moral and ethically pure so that when I die I get to go to heaven.
Yeah.
He taught to be moral and ethically pure because if you're not, you're going to suffer.
Right.
It's just a practical
yeah,
teaching.
Right.
It's not a moral teaching.
Right, right.
In that way. It's not a moral in the sense that I'm going to get punished for being, for acting immoral. I am right here, right now. So you're doing very well, Jen, and so I'm looking forward to you preserving the Dhamma.
We'll see.
In years
yeah.
to come.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
your assignment.
Yeah,
that's
right,
assignment.
Right. No pressure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not much to ask.
Thank you, Lorna. Good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you for your teaching. Sometimes when you come to class, there's just one sort of little bit you get. And I think from this morning's teaching, I think my mission next week maybe is to just be mindful of impermanence and the
be mindful of impermanence to end conceit.
And which that is just the flow of life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just. It's always there, but like you say, everything's so subtle you don't see it,
yeah.
but we know it's there. And I think, as I say, just from this morning's teaching, I think that's probably something that I could just take from this class and just be a little bit more mindful of this week and see where that gets
mm-hmm.
Can't wait to hear where it gets you.
Okay.
It's quarter, you got to go. See you Tuesday.
Bye. Yep. Bye now.
Bye, Lauren.
Let me get ask Mary to join us. Why did I do that?
Hi, John.
Hi, Mary. I was just going to unmute your mic. You did it for me. How are you?
I'm so tech savvy. Spreading
out. How did you, you heard the Sambodhi Sutta for the second time this week. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I always benefit from hearing things more than once. I always hear different things as I'm listening. I do sometimes find the politics of some of this stuff a little bit distracting. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the three marks, you know, I think I'm, you know, a student on a journey, and, you know, there's more for me to understand there. But with each time that I hear it, I'm thinking about how I incorporate, how first my comprehension and then my incorporation into the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I often look back on the week I just had and think about how this insight would, you know, help me better off the cushion. So very useful, and I'm very grateful for the Dhamma and you, John, and everyone in the Sangha. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Please say hello to David.
I will.
Anthony.
Good morning.
Good to see you this morning. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. You too. I listening to Jen, I appreciate her dilemma, but Jen is in the unique experience of being a teacher.
Yeah.
And she can incorporate some of the concepts we're learning without calling it Buddhism. I mean, you know, just you don't have to say meditate on your breath.
Right.
You could say take a moment and pause.
Yeah.
Practice. You can introduce compassion. You can introduce gratitude in very subtle ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, it's one step at a time. Rome wasn't built in a day. You know, we don't. I mean, I'm thinking like a good example is we now, salsa is the biggest condiment. We now eat guacamole. We're not at tamales or mole yet, but we're getting Mexican food introduced. It's kind of like that. You can introduce, you're in a very unique position to introduce things to impressionable young children who could then benefit from that and bring it out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we don't call it Buddhism, but the concepts can be passed along.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, unfortunately, I think the reason Buddhism is in the place it is because in some societies and in some cultures, it has become a religion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
If they had just stuck with the concepts, you know, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Right.
Yeah, but that started almost immediately after the Buddha's death, that they wanted to make it a religion, even if that wasn't the word that they used. Even the, you know, the Mahasanghikas, 100 years after the Buddha's passing, that was their... That's what they wanted, was a religion. You know, I would classify most modern Buddhism as religious in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are based on faith and belief and merit, which is all part of religion, isn't it?
Yeah.
In one way or another. I don't think I've come across any modern Buddhist practice that didn't incorporate at least some faith, belief, and merit. And those are three things that the Buddha said, you don't need it. You know, it's just distractions. So.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to point out, this is the first time I ever heard a concept that I've become aware of, and I'm probably bet a lot of people have, is that what happens when you practice this is you notice that you don't get along with some of your friends the way you used to, and you develop new friends, and you sort of don't want to be with some of the old ones. And the point was made in that sutta that be with your sangha, and be with people who are like you in a way it as a benefit. And I didn't realize that was ever introduced in a sutta because it was in my mind. You know, that urge is there to want to be with people. You're more, that you have more, that practice more of these concepts and principles.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's why I say we're so fortunate what's developed here. A well-focused sangha. This is rare. It really is rare in the world. Even the Anapanasati Sutta, one of the most famous suttas, the Buddha, he's using about 25, maybe 26 accomplished monks and nuns as an example. He says, these people are rare in the world. This is 2,600 years ago. It's just as rare today that people actually take to the Dhamma and develop it. You know, it's just the way it is. But it needs to be, at least from the standpoint of a teacher, it needs to be acknowledged. at least I think if you're going to teach, if you're going to teach something that somebody else taught and call it that, which I do, you should have some fidelity towards that. I think not some, all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because it's the only way that I see that it works. I mean, this is from my own experience. If I wanted to be a modern Buddhist teacher, I could do that too, and we might have a bigger group here, but it wouldn't be nearly as effective, would it? You know?
That's what is true.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and it took me a while to let go of even that idea that this is something that should be incorporated and applied. You were talking about something that I should adapt it and accommodate to mollify and acquiesce to certain people. And that's almost an underlying human characteristic that is very subtly tied into eye making or people pleasing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yep.
Because if my self-worth is based on how many people actually listen to me or buy my books, honestly, I'm going to change what I'm saying and what I'm teaching.
Yep,
because this, yeah, honestly, you know, if my business is to do something, I want to do something that the great majority of people are going to want, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have the...
It ain't. It's not. It's not
my this. My school has, you know, every year they have professional development days where the teachers can be, you know, there's opportunities for teachers to teach other teachers.
Mm.
And all of the teachers want to incorporate mindfulness into those days. So I see this opportunity of like being able to teach mindfulness, and I'm, you know, I feel like I, in a public school setting, not comfortable doing it because I don't want to teach in the context of, you know, a sutta or the Buddhist teaching. Because that's what I know, and that's what is developing my concentration practice, and anything else is not what I can contribute. So it's, you know, it is. I mean, that's fine. That's okay. I can let that opportunity kind of like, you know.
Well, you could teach kind of a more generic type of Buddhism, just. Well, not only watered down, but you could teach a way of dealing with stress to kids. You got a group of kids, 12, 14 years old, whatever
sure.
it is.
Yeah, yeah.
To teach them that when you feel stressed out or distracted or agitated, take a moment and teach them this. Be mindful of your breath. Take a few breaths and just think about your breath for a few moments. And then notice that the feelings and the thoughts that you had, how quickly they change. And that's all you need to teach them.
Yeah.
And they're getting a basic look at impermanence then.
No, this is grown-ups. I'm more thinking
this
about
is
grown-ups.
Yeah.
Well, you could take that and just expand it a little bit. They don't even have to know where it comes from unless they're interested. When I do a lot of work with
I don't think that's terribly dishonest not to tell them. I mean,
it's not dishonest at all.
Yeah.
Most people
want.
It's
a dilemma though, Jen, that you feel like if you're going to teach what the Buddha taught, you should say you're teaching what the Buddha taught.
Yeah.
But
the concepts are generic.
Yeah, I don't see anything dishonest about it. I work a lot with addicts and compulsive people, and when I first sit down, there's things that I teach them that have nothing to do with the Dhamma, but I do teach them meditation. But I'm I tell them what the meditation, where it's from, but I don't tell them they have to become Buddhist in order to meditate.
Okay.
Use this meditation within this other framework that I've taught, and they do fine. People that actually do that, the great percentage, about 85% to 90%, actually stay clean, sober, abstinent, whatever it is, which is remarkable. But the people that come to me at that point are usually very highly motivated too, so it skews the numbers a little bit.
Right.
But it's far greater than the 2 or 3% that make it in 12-step programs today.
Mm-hmm.
But they I don't insist that they become Buddhist. But a few are interested in learning more, and then they do.
Yeah.
You know, but on the I just teach them that.
Yeah.
And even as an emotional way to teach them to better stay present with what's coming up is to teach them that look at that feeling or that an emotion is a thought attached to a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Look at how impermanent that emotion is. Just come back to your breath and nine times out of ten, it's gone, isn't it? So why make a big deal? I mean, is it practical? Why make a big deal over something that's just in your head?
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it comes and goes. So and that's a good way to introduce it. And then when people are more interested, they show more interest, tell them to come to your classes when you start teaching here. Lisa, good to see you this morning.
She's going to need an extra plate.
Well, I'm sorry, what did you say?
I said she's going to need an extra plate because the one she's got now is full.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine. I got more.
Good morning, Lisa.
Well, as usual, I have so many things rolling around in my head. Because of the discussion, two words came to mind. One, philosophy, and the other, psychology. And I think that the ideas of Buddha's teachings can be taught or incorporated into conversations and also actions when a person is interacting with other people without ever mentioning Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the great thing about it, because I don't know whether you would call it a philosophy of life. I don't know what philosophy is, really, because philosophers are people that take those incomprehensible classes, and they get into these discussions like, I don't know what planet I'm on or they're on or anything else. It's so esoteric, but
Buddhism, you mean the Buddha's Dhamma?
No,
yeah.
The
philosophy, yes.
So-called philosophy.
Yep.
I don't know who. They get into these discussions. I have no idea what they are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Buddhism is not difficult. It's told in very accessible ways.
Yes.
It can be adapted in many, many different ways into people's lives. But
yes.
I'll try to keep it personal, my life. I'm friends with a lot of people who are in many ways very different from me. People who may be very religious in different ways, with very firm beliefs. People who have different politics. But I think that's good for me,
mm-hmm.
personally.
Yeah, it's good for everybody. Too bad not enough people do that.
But the idea, I see it two different ways. The idea to, and there are people, sometimes I'll overhear conversations, or I see what certain people are doing, or what's going on in bars and things like that, and I just think, I could never, ever be part of that world. I just can't. It's me. Just sort of being a more, you know, sort of introverted, quieter, and or whatever it is they're talking about. Oh my gosh, I could never be friends with that person or whatever. But sometimes with friendships, I don't know if other people have this experience, is that sometimes you really like someone, they may be very different, but there's something that connects you, and it's like, I don't really like that person, even though they have, you know, whatever, but you can still be friends, you can still,
mm-hmm.
you know, talk about things. But I think, in the past, I think Anthony has mentioned about situations he's found himself in his profession, and different situations, and then some of the things that Jen brought up, is that these things can be, you know, well, you're sort of an emissary or for Buddhism. When that's what I,
mm-hmm.
that's what we all would, I would like to be. But I'm like nowhere, you know. I just feel like I'm at the I'm at the very beginning. I have a hard time understanding concepts, and you're always saying, like, and do you understand that? And I don't know whether I'm sorry, I don't know whether I do or not, because my mind is just too full of stuff. I'm still trying to get rid of a lot of stuff in here. But, you know, don't we want to sort of have ourselves as, you know, at least we're attempting to act in certain ways that would kind of go along with Buddhist teachings. And we don't have to say that that's what it is or why do you say that or whatever. It's just being, Buddhist teachings are just getting incorporated into our lives and becoming part of who we are.
Yeah. The Buddha taught for 45 years, and never once did he call himself a Buddhist. Mm. Not once. Mm. And he never even called his, like you hear these sayings, like the center's called the Flying White Lotus Center or whatever you might. He never even described in a unique way his personal sangha. Like the reference, the beginning of the suttas always describe where he was, not the building, not Siddhartha Gautama's home, you know, or Siddhartha Gautama's palace, or Siddhartha Gautama's summer home. It was always, well, he's here in the woods here, or here in the woods there, because there was no eye making in that. We don't have to classify it as anything. And I usually don't. When people ask me, in general, people ask me what I do, I say, well, I write and I teach mindfulness and meditation. And usually people's eyes start glassing over right there, and I don't have to go any further. But then if they're interested a little bit, I say, well, yeah, I teach a simple meditation method that's part of a broader framework called an Eightfold Path, and then their eyes glass over and I'm done. And if they're still interested, I go a little bit further. But there's no hard and fast rule. As we live in the world, we interact with people in a way that's appropriate. Now, one of the reasons why I started the teacher training, Matt and I talked about, is not necessarily to have teachers in class sitting here. It's so you understand how to teach others. That's even a more important aspect of, teacher training, just how to express it to others. The other thing to keep in mind in this talk about Buddhist religion, etc., and it's not, is that even as Buddhist practitioners practicing the pure Dhamma, who have established great benefit from it, it's hard to not be enthusiastic and want all our friends and relatives and everybody else and take it across the whole planet, and everybody should know this. That's a good way to feel, but also understand the First Noble Truth. Mm-hmm. Dukkha occurs. There's not likely going to be a worldwide acceptance of this Dhamma ever. Mm-hmm. Meaning the Buddha understood that. He never saw himself as a savior. We shouldn't.
Right.
Even in a one-on-one basis, we shouldn't see ourselves as saving another person, no matter how much we might care for them or how much they might seem to need this. Because that can cloud our expression of the Dhamma, our teaching of the Dhamma. So all we have to do is to develop the Dhamma. I mean, the Buddha teaches this too. We develop the Dhamma for ourselves. And then if other people are open to it, we can teach them, mostly by example. But if they're not open to it, that's okay too. Mm-hmm. You know, again, I don't feel any compulsion to go to Zen Mountain Monastery and tell them what I know. That would be the essence of arrogance, wouldn't it? It'd be the essence of wrong speech if I did that. In fact, I was asked to go up to Boston and give a presentation at a certain place, and I turned it down because I would just be one of many so-called, I'd be the Buddhist teacher of the day, and I think the Dhamma deserves more than that. You know, they couldn't understand the idea of associating it, and this center does a lot of strange things anyway, that I didn't want to associate the Buddha's Dhamma with other things like that. I just don't think it works well, so keep it pure. But it's simple too, isn't it? You know, but it has to be experienced. So we can talk a little bit to people, but unless we can get them to actually experience it. Let me go to Nick, because Nick, you had really no idea what I was talking about, but I explained it as best I could. But you came and experienced it, and that's when you could develop a certain commitment to it, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and if you want to talk about that, fine, you can talk about anything you want, though.
Well, let's go backwards a second, and I just want to discuss one thing that we just talked about. In theory, I find myself when I say whatever I say seems to be still needs a lot of work to get to where I want to be. But theoretically, if I want to avoid suffering, I should only associate myself with people that are rooted in the Dhamma.
The quick answer is sure, yes. But realistically, is that realistic? No.
Right.
We live in the world. The Buddha didn't do that. He didn't isolate himself from the world to protect his Dhamma. In fact, he was more active in the world after his awakening than before.
I think the point is recognize that engaging with people who practice the Dhamma will lessen stress.
Yeah, and also as part of your Dhamma practice, you cannot overlook the importance of a well-focused Sangha. This is a common theme to the Buddhist teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not likely that everybody in the world is going to take to the Dhamma today.
What?
But it's also likely that I'm going to have to interact with people that aren't developing the Dhamma. And that's where the Dhamma really comes in handy, because
yes.
I can maintain my level, and I couldn't do this before. I mean, I spent my first 30 some odd years deeply entangled in the world and confused and frustrated and angry and fearful and deluded. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. Well, what was wrong with me is I didn't understand what I was doing. I didn't understand who I was in relation to the environment I was in. I was living a life based on fabrications, based on five clinging aggregates. And it can only be, at the very least, unsatisfying.
Yeah.
But at the very at its most common level, it's unsatisfying, it's stressful, it's painful, it's distracting. It's all of the above. Mm-hmm. But when we start taking to the Dhamma very quickly, we start regaining our minds, don't we? And I'm asking you, Nick, because it seems like you have.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the middle road. We have to deal with people who we disagree with politically,
yeah.
but we also
yeah.
need to be with people we agree with. Just because, why would you subject yourself to constant stress with people you don't really care for in some way?
You
have to find that balance.
You have
to. It's the middle way.
And it doesn't matter who you're sitting with. I would love to have a closed, maybe I'll have it on a Sunday, have a closed class with Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi, and Chuck Schumer.
You'd be the moderator.
And just to teach them a little bit of Dhamma and see where they go with it.
No, I think it would have to last at least 50 years.
see Donald Trump sitting right here, like, on a cushion.
Nobody meditates better than me.
That's terrible.
He'd probably be sending you tweets to you.
That's wrong speech. I apologize.
I could get him to build a wall around all the people that aren't practicing the Dhamma.
Yeah.
Low energy, John.
The point they're getting to the little bit more subtle aspects of this. It's not a salvific religion that we're doing. There's great freedom in that once you understand it too. And it's a hard thing for a self-referential ego personality to understand that the most loving thing it can do is to take to the Dhamma and let go of all those self-referential ideals, because that's where all the suffering comes from in the world.
Yeah.
And it sounds, it's really a slight paradox that the most selfless thing I can do is to take care of myself first and awaken. Because then I see clearly that suffering is inherent in the world and it's not something that I can ever change. The Buddha realized this. People living on planet Earth within this universe are always going to suffer as a consequence of having a human life. Now, we can create social systems that can help make life more pleasant. Whether that happens or not, that's part of politics, isn't it? But inherent in having a human life is sickness, aging, and death. It's always going to be difficult. It's always going to be stressful. it's always going to be a situation of me not getting what I want and getting what I don't want. This is how the Buddha described it. But if my mind is fabricated, then I believe I'm simply this five clinging aggregates, and I'm attached to everything then that is impermanent. There's my suffering. Or I can recognize it for myself, let go of all those fabricated views, which, by the way, is possible. We're all doing it. And then I can live my life as an example of how to live a human life, which is really what the Buddha did. You know, he was probably the world's greatest teacher, but he was also the world's greatest example. In fact, he was an example of what he taught, probably better than anyone, even me. And that's really all we can do. And Jen, I would say that you are developing that. You are as much of an example of your knowledge as you are expressing your knowledge. Does everybody understand that?
Mm-hmm.
Just by living our life. And you all are too, in very real ways. You've made some profound changes, Anthony. And I would say that about every one of you too. But I was just going to say, Anthony, it's remarkable the changes that Anthony has made in just a short time.
Thank you.
And it's not just, full disclosure, it's not just coming here. It's mindfulness-based stress reduction was very important, right? I mean, for you and establishing your level of mindfulness. It's not to be discounted. But again, this isn't a salvific religion. It's a very specific practice that works best when it's kept pure. And then we can do other things in our life to a much more effective way. Becky, good to see you this morning.
Good, really good to be here. To go back, I just want to say one, what I think is an important thing I got out of this lesson today, and make sure that I am thinking about it correctly, is that impermanence, there is a bigger way to think about impermanence than I've been thinking about it, I think. Because it is connecting impermanence to sort of like everything. For example, you said to Lorna, you want to be the best rose pruner.
Yeah.
And if you can look at your roses with right view, you can realize that is impermanent. I should not be personally connected to this rose bush because it is impermanent. But you can still admire the rose bush now in a bigger way because you're not focused on making it be the way you want it to be.
That's right.
Is that impermanence?
I can take care of the roses, but they're not mine.
Right.
You know, there's no self-identification. It's just a nice thing, isn't it? Prune your roses.
Is that part of impermanence? Is impermanence connected to that idea?
All things in the world are impermanent, mm-hmm. including the roses. So it's by self-identifying with the roses. It's the stress of, I got to get these roses pruned perfectly because people are coming later on.
Yes.
That's eye making. Rather than just enjoying a Saturday afternoon pruning the roses. And again, you might have a technique that you've developed that, you know, that needs to be cut this way, a quarter inch above this nodule.
Uh-huh.
And you follow that because that's your understanding. But that's just your understanding.
Right.
It's not because you need to be. And what I was referencing about Lorna is the idea that I have to be the world's best rose pruner is a fabrication. And it's establishing yourself in this imaginary realm of the world's greatest rose pruners. Which, by the way, once you think about it, you've established a realm. It's not
mm-hmm.
real,
mm-hmm.
but you've stuck yourself in a place that's not real, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's stressful. Because now you got to live in it.
So much.
I feel like also, though, when you're considering impermanence, just to kind of bring it back to what Lauren and I were talking about with sticking our heads together, is that when you went for the rose example, for example, is you see the roses and you love the roses, but even your feeling about the rose is impermanent, and your interpretation of the rose is impermanent, and your idea about how the rose looks today is impermanent. So yeah. All of that also kind of helps you to let go of
your attachment to the rose.
You're trying to change the rose. You know?
Yeah. And then you can appreciate the vagaries of all roses
and then you can see
dandelions and puppies and everything.
You see it with a much more expansive view. You see it with a much more expansive view. You see many more possibilities when you can let go of that.
One more question here.
Sure.
When someone walks by and says, "Lorna, those are beautiful. Your rose bushes are beautiful." Should you not? Is that just? Oh well. Don't worry. I don't really care what you're saying because the rose bushes aren't going to be here tomorrow.
Oh, I would be very sincere in saying thank you.
Yeah.
Why? Because it's respectful and that's how you live in the world. It's up to me whether I'm taking that personally, if it's swelling my head. You know?
But shouldn't you
feel, I mean, people tell me...
Can't you feel good about it?
You should feel good about it.
Yeah.
You just shouldn't identify with it. Your happiness isn't dependent on you having the world's perfect roses.
You just shouldn't
just what
expect
you do.
Everybody else that's going to walk by now is going to say how beautiful your roses are.
And if they don't,
attached
to if you need that, if you need that constant approval, that's eye making. And
you've set
yourself up for stress. It's not something that just happened. It's not because the world is a certain way. I'm upset right now because you didn't acknowledge my beautiful roses. Well, it's because of my attachment to them. But if I just enjoyed pruning roses, period. It doesn't have to be. The difficulty we're all having with this idea is we can't see the activity without the eye in it. Mm. But take the Dhatuvabhanga Sutta. A person is made up of the four elements, earth, wind, fire, water, a sixth property known as space. We need space to define things, and the sixth property of consciousness. That's all. So it's these six properties that's pruning the rose bushes. So what? It's just that's what happened. And for me to take anything more out of it is going to cause me upset. It doesn't matter how you're looking at my roses in a certain way. Really has nothing to do with me. Whether you say you like them or not, or it's the worst prune, it doesn't matter. What I'm holding in mind is what's important. And what I'm holding in mind in this moment, as you walked up the street and came to look at my rose bushes, is I'm mindful of a human being walking up the street, and hopefully I'm not distracted by my roses. Do you see? Because if I'm distracted by my roses, I might resent the fact that you're coming down the street. Or anything else. So, Nick, do you understand where I'm getting? Because you brought up the point. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't enjoy our lives. In fact, it means just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
The intention shouldn't be to enjoy every moment, but every moment will be meaningful because we're present for it. It doesn't have to be a certain way. We could decide that it's a nice afternoon. I think I'm going to go prune my roses. And I go out and I find out that the deer ate all my roses. Well, I could take it personally, couldn't I? And go get the biggest shotgun I can find and kill all the deer. Some people would say it's a good idea. Or I could just look at it and appreciate the fact that, you know, other people ate too. Other people. Other sentient beings ate. Again, it's just depersonalizing this experience. But it doesn't mean that experiences aren't real. They're more real because I'm present for it. I don't need to own my roses to enjoy pruning roses.
So,
somebody says your roses are nice.
I guess what I was going to say was, in response to Nick's question, Nick, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that if it's not that you should or shouldn't have a feeling, if somebody comments on your roses and when they walk by and that fills you with pride, then you should recognize that that feeling is arising and recognize that it will pass away. And that's it. That's it.
Yep.
It's not judgment of the feeling arising. Nothing. Nothing else. Just it's, I recognize that that feeling is arising and that it's passing, that it's going to pass away. And that is all.
That's it. If I decide that that I've just pruned all my roses and they're so beautiful, I've never done a better job, and Nick comes walking down the street and says, that's no good. I've set myself up to be hurt that way too, haven't I?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just, it doesn't matter. I'm going to prune the roses because I like pruning roses. It doesn't really matter what other people think of it. But when I do, when I get caught up in that, that's called self-reference. And that creates stress and suffering in my life.
This talk has made me realize something I never thought of before. When we see someone severely handicapped and it becomes upsetting to us, it's because they don't look the way we expect them to be.
A lot of that is. It's a lot of it is self-reference, and if we can pierce through that
and see the beauty in them as a person, they take on their own beauty. It doesn't have to be like everyone else.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And when we can do it there, we should be able to do it everywhere. Meaning with, it's still, we've come a long way as far as race relations in another way, we haven't really changed that much because as a society, I think we are overall less racially driven. And there's systems in place that no longer support racism where they used to be. I mean, sit at the back of the bus. I mean, that was in our lifetime. You can't sit at this counter. Man, imagine that. But it's much better that way. But there's still an underlying level of racism that it's and other types of bigotry that we can't just ignore. But what's the solution? The solution isn't legislation. The solution is the Dhamma. You know, ultimately. You know, in the meantime, we do the best we can by trying to manage people through our laws and rules, etc. But ultimately, it's through liberation, by liberating our minds, that we'll free ourselves of that. Yeah, it was a great discussion this morning.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, please.
The thing that that's become very important to me is the realization that everything I say is for the benefit of my family. Everything that I focus on is to take care of my family. And the thing that I've come to realize is the most selfless thing that I can do is to take care of myself.
That's
if I don't take care, if not taking care of myself, I can't do a good job taking care of my family.
That's wonderful.
That's where I am right
that
now.
That
high
is
five.
Such,
high
really
five.
That
you
is
got it.
That's probably the most important
that's
thing you've
huge.
Learned. Really. And I know to some people it would sound selfish, but how can I take care of anybody else if I can't take care of myself? If I refuse to? I mean, there's so much of ignoring your own needs. It's a very good strategy to be always helping others if you don't want to change anything yourself, because you look good doing it, don't you? But look at all the difficulties that happen in the world through altruistic intentions, but lacking wisdom. Mm-hmm. So we have to incorporate that. Yeah, a great class. Next week we will. It's going to be a new sutta called the Giri Mananda Sutta. It's just another great sutta on the three marks of existence. But you can review this if you want coming up to next week. But we'll spend 3 weeks on this. All right, let's finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditation posture, gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways. peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Thank you, Mary. Peace.
Hi, Mary. Bye, Mary.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.